Right eye dominant.
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 This is the Right Eye Dominant Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I am your host, Nick Toro Jr. Today's episode is the final episode for season two. And I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that when I started this podcast almost 2 years ago, it really was just a passion project. And I wasn't sure if it was really going to go anywhere or if anyone would be listening. But lo and behold, here we are at the end of two full seasons. And you are out there listening to this right now. And I just want to extend a word of gratitude and appreciation to you for coming along for the ride. And for today's episode, I'm really super excited to present to you an interview with a real giant of contemporary photography. And I don't throw that word around lightly. My guest today is photographer Susan Mizellis. Susan has made a career out of bridging the world of photojournalism, documentary photography, while also making her way into the museum, gallery, and book publishing world, which is really what led me to this interview today. Back in August last year, when I was in Berlin, I attended a show that was entitled Susan Mizellis Mediations. This was a full career encompassing exhibition that covered Susan's work from when she first got out of college all the way to work she's making today. The work is astounding, it is varied, and it is powerful. The work that really drew me in was a project called Carnival Strippers. And that work is probably the main focus of this conversation, but Susan and I talk about a whole range of topics related to her body of work. You might not know Susan or her work, but I guarantee you've seen it somewhere if you're even marginally interested in photography. The work that she conducted during the war in Nicaragua in the 1980s is a monumental body of work. And if that's all she did in her career, I would still consider her a giant in the field. You have probably seen images from that body of work, including one iconic photo that we did talk about. I don't want to spoil all the fun. I'd rather just get into the conversation. So without further ado, thank you for joining me today. Final episode of season two, my conversation with Susan Mizellis. So Susan Mizellis, welcome to the Right Eye Dominant Podcast.
Hi.
Thanks for taking time out of your clearly busy
crazy life
to talk to me. I really do appreciate it. So as we were just chatting before I started recording, I like to start with sort of like what the origin story is to your career, but I don't, you know, that could take up all the time that we have to talk, and I want to respect your schedule. So I'm going to just dive into some of the things that struck me, starting with the Prince Street Girls. Can we talk a little bit about like what drew you to that project originally? What was it that opened the door for you to make a photo project about those girls?
Yeah, you know, Nick, I think if you saw the show, you'll get a sense, or what we hoped viewers would get a sense of, is the beginnings of thinking about photographs and the not so much the life of a photographer, but what one was considering as a photographer, you know. So it begins, actually, their early work is Prince Street Girls, but before that, 44 Irving Street, in which I'm working with a camera I almost never work with again, a 4x5 in my boarding house, where I'm very awkward about making a portrait of my neighbors who I don't actually know. So I have to open the door, knock on the door, open the door, say who I am, and I don't know why I'm making that photograph of them. So I bring it back to them and ask them how they feel about the person they see in the photograph as a contact print. And they write me notes about how they see themselves. And I think that's a really seminal project that then ricochets through the show, this question of relationship to subject over time. So Prince Street Girls comes very naturally to me in my neighborhood of Little Italy, where I'm actually teaching as a public school teacher, teaching photography in the South Bronx at the time. Mm-hmm. So I would come back, I'd be around on the weekends, I'd be around after school, as would they. And there's no plan to that series of photographs. There's no intention. I didn't know. And in fact, it was very late, maybe 40 years later, that I actually published a small book of those photographs. So on the other hand, it's an expression of a kind of street photography, different than the kind that I was seeing around me on the walls, let's say at MoMA. Mm-hmm. You know, Gary Winogrand, Lee Friedlander, famous figures such as that, who had a different approach to street photography, which also I felt uncomfortable with. So I found my own way to build a relationship over time with these girls, little moments of them really posing for each other as much as for me, and becoming young women over a period of time.
Well, let me just touch on something you just mentioned. So the work of, let's say, Friedlander or Winogrand, what was it that made you uncomfortable about their approach or their images?
Well, I mean, it was certainly, Friedlander's a brilliant photographer and has done many different kinds of projects. But what I'm talking about is, for example, Winogrand's Women Are Beautiful. It was very assaulting to me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't relational to the subject, which is the thing, I guess, in my life, I needed to make sense of the kind of photography I would progressively come to do. So I'm not making a comment on what may work for them. It's mm-hmm. just finding the visual language and the approach that can work for you. I think you see this a lot in younger emerging photographers now. There's a huge amount of self-reflection, self-portraiture, or reenactments, or constructed and directed portraiture. There's a lot of comfort in doing that because, mm-hmm. It's consensual. Right. Street photography isn't necessarily. And the people who are in those photographs may never see them. So when I bring the photographs back, that becomes a very important, not just a gesture, but part of a circle that makes the making of photographs make sense for me.
Yeah. So it sounds like to me that there's a couple of notes that I took seeing the show. Clearly there's trust. You have to build trust between you and your subjects. And what you're describing, even with the 4x5s in the boarding house, is there's a conversation that needs to happen to create the place for the pictures to be made. And it seems to me that's a critical part of your process. How much of that is it a lot of work ahead of time before the camera even comes out, generally speaking?
Well, sometimes, I mean, with Irving Street, obviously, I lived in the boarding house. So we would pass each other in the hallways, whether or not we spend any time over tea together. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think I photograph myself as a kind of part of the series. I think it's different with Prince Street Girls. Because they lived on my block, they would actually come to my loft. They saw the prints being made. It was many, many decades later, as I said, that I published a small book and had a gallery show. And even then, I had no idea how they would feel seeing their younger selves on the walls, framed, matted and framed beautifully up on Madison Avenue. And it was fantastic when they came. It was a celebration of themselves that they, I think, enjoyed. But I had no idea how they would feel, you know,
yeah.
In the way that we all look back at younger photographs and wish we were then, as
yeah,
we
right.
are now,
right.
And we're not. And yet there's some pleasure in seeing that younger self. So it was a surprise. I don't think you ever know. And the question is, in what way can you open that dialogue?
Right, right. And so sort of springboarding from that into the Carnival Strippers series, obviously you're dealing with an environment where there's a power dynamic at play. the idea of the male gaze, obviously, which you're sort of surrounded by, yet you are clearly making a connection with the strippers themselves, and you're embedded into their reality. Again, like what was the process of entering that world, earning their trust, and really even before that, like what attracted you to that?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious why it was attractive. I mean, I'd never seen a young girl on what looked like an auction block standing in front of a fairgrounds with men surrounding and pointing and whispering and paying money to go see her strip under a tent, you know? I mean, who wouldn't be curious? You said something earlier, and I didn't mention it, but of course, this question of trust and patience and waiting is very intuitive. In the case of strippers, you know, I was in the fairgrounds like everyone else looking at them for the first summer. I didn't have permission to come in. And it was only through almost an incidental encounter with one of the strippers in the public bathroom that led to an invitation to seeing the dressing room. And then when I came back the second summer and found the same managers, not necessarily the same girls, but the managers kind of welcomed me back. I mean, under these, you know, that this is a very long time ago, the 70s, and, you know, it's almost 50 years. I guess it is 50 years since I started that work. And it took three summers. One summer I was just really working at around the fairgrounds and the carnivals themselves, and then progressively interested, and three summers following them weekend to weekend, town to town, as they put the tent up and took it down and was on the road in between. I would go back to Boston, process the contact sheets, bring them back the following weekend. So share the process of how I was seeing them. Again, they were seeing them, not so much the men in the audience, but the women and the managers. So there was nothing hidden or secretive in that sense. Though it was a big secret what was happening under the tent for women who were excluded from the tent.
Mm.
So I only saw what was happening in under the tent by looking through the curtain of the dressing room initially.
Hmm.
Eventually, I mean, the manager knew and understood that I was going to dress as a man and go in the back of the tent. And as long as I didn't compromise his show in any way, he was fine with that. And that's how I did photograph in the end some of the work that's in the back of the show as the women are performing for the men and men only.
Wow. So
all of that is about trust. I mean, building trust, and it becomes a cliche. It's feeling comfortable yourself, that other people feel trusting of you. You get a sense. I mean, it's as much how you talk to them and look at them and all the kinds of ways we relate to each other. I mean, I wasn't thinking of myself even then as a professional photographer. All through working on carnival strippers, I'm still teaching photography to fourth graders, fifth and sixth graders. You know, I'm believing that photographs are a very rich experience to connect people in the world, as it did for me.
Mm. Obviously, there was a rapport. It's just obvious in the photos with the women and carnival strippers, and it sounds like also you had an understanding with the managers. Just my assumption would have been that may have been a harder bridge to cross.
Yeah, progressively. Yeah. But they saw themselves as powerful. You know,
yeah.
They had economically powerful, you know, a lot of cash was moving around. And as long as I wasn't compromising their business, if anything, maybe they thought it was great. I was celebrating their business. I don't know. You can read I think the other point about strippers is it's unusual in that period of the 70s to see the voice of the subjects. Of course, the voice is rendered in text in the book. But in fact, when I first showed the work, you heard the voices and looked at the photographs. And those voices included the managers and the men and the girls interacting with the men, as well as the managers, as well as amongst themselves. So there was a richness to this array of how they saw themselves at work. at that time.
And then as far as the audiences that were at those shows, did you ever, the way you were describing it, almost staying in the background or shooting through the curtains, or were you ever challenged or confronted or like, what was the dynamic between you and the crowd as this project went on?
Yeah, you know, the difference of the crowd, meaning the people in the fairgrounds, were very easily accessible. And I talked to many, there are a lot of references in the book to man in audience or interaction between two men that might have been more likely that was in on the fairground strip rather than under the tent where they were focused on the women. So the, you know, I wouldn't have been wandering around under the tent interviewing them. I might have interviewed them when they left or before when they were waiting online to go in to the show, that kind of thing. I don't remember. I think, again, I probably said this somewhere or other, but, you know, being a woman with a camera at that time was, you know, unexpected for most of them, probably. And they didn't take me very seriously, I'm sure.
Hmm.
Including people who were professionally involved in photography. So, you know, in those situations, no one confronted me, though obviously in any situation, people who don't want to be photographed, who see you making a photograph, can turn their heads or turn their backs. And you see that in the dressing room as well. Hmm. Some of the women didn't want to be photographed, and I respected that.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't object to being in the picture as long as their faces weren't revealed, for example.
Hmm.
I mean, there were a few tensions in the sense of we weren't yet referring to the male gaze, actually, in 72 and 3 when I started this work. You see it operating, and you mm-hmm. see that it's not surprising that by 75, the feminist movement is talking about the male gaze because it was so prevalent. But I don't remember any really direct confrontations. In some sometimes I think the men were probably performing themselves as much as the women were.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think about the photograph of the young boy at the show surrounded by the older men. And there's, you know, there now where there's layers of story there that goes even beyond just sort of the story of, let's say, the story of the women performing or the story of the managers who wield so much power. And this so much said in that image of sort of this introduction or indoctrination into, again, the male gaze or an introduction to sexuality or things like that. And just to bring another layer to that story or that environment, that image in particular really just resonated with me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's well said, and it gets at the bonding, that's very particular bonding that was happening between generations and the separation of gender at that time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Being women being looked at, talked about, there was a lot of, you know, I think that young boy represents all the future men, you know.
Absolutely.
I wish I could find him now. It would be fantastic if I could find him now and say, so do you even remember that moment?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a show that a colleague of mine has done, Cristina de Medill, who's Spanish and just has a show. And it's a book coming out called The Gentleman's Club, in which she interviews men who frequent prostitutes. And they talk very openly about why they do and how much they pay and how often they go. And it's mesmerizing to read.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's private, and yet they're very comfortable with it being public.
Well,
and so when you think about some of these photographs, the men are not on the backstage. That's in the open fairgrounds.
It's interesting that you're bringing that up, and it actually will probably segue into the next body of work that I want to talk about. But the whole idea of this very public display of women in a very festive, I mean, if it's a carnival, you know, there's people going there for all sorts of reasons. And that seems to just be this sort of like part of of the entire experience. And yet it's dealing with it's dealing with women revealing themselves physically, right? Like stripping themselves bare in front of a crowd. It's not a private one-on-one interaction. It's the idea of any sexual element. It's almost like the same thing, like if it's a strip club where, you know, your men are with other men, creating this interaction with performers. It's sexual, but it's there's just no intimacy to it. And I go back to that young boy. And as you said, like, do all men see themselves somewhat in that boy, in his, like, what did it feel like to be in that environment? Was he afraid? Was he intimidated? Was he
excited and curious? And
right.
Did he want to touch her right then? Or did he want to be just fascinated by the classic madre?
Yeah.
For you know, yeah. The mother, etc. I mean, you know, you're referring to a crowd, and the crowd is really what's on the fairgrounds. And you're right that people who are coming to the fair, the carnival, you know, the rides and the games and the popcorn and candy and all of that is surrounding this girl show, these girl shows, because there were several of them very often at the same time, kind of competing with each other. But there are also the oxen pull and the largest tomato. It's the end of the harvest. And so, at least in the U.S. tradition, I don't know about Europe, it's an agricultural fair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the other side of this large arena, you would have been looking at the best crops. And as I say, you know, competitions that involve the animals that they, you know, like oxen pull and horse pull, all of this. So it's a very special kind of atmosphere, very dense, with people moving constantly around, bringing their kids or bringing their wives or hanging out together, getting drunk.
So that being said, and I 100%, I'm here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We have the state fair here every year, and it always has been primarily an agricultural, rural sort of coming together and all of those things that you described. And I think the difference in the time that has passed since you did Carnival Strippers is that, like, to me, that whole the idea of that, you know, these shows were just part of the fabric of what was going on at these carnivals is it's to me, it's almost unbelievable to the point where that wouldn't fly. I mean, with it's like we've moved on from that in many ways. Many ways, I guess we haven't. But, you know, that right. it is interesting to me to imagine that, like, you know, well, the kids are going to go to the petting zoo and dad's going to go and check out the stripper show.
Right. Well, you know, you have to remember in time, and a lot has happened in our society since then, because pornography was just beginning with video, mm-hmm. you know, this, you know, and lap clubs were not yet prevalent in probably every city and town in America as it is now. And those were private environments. And what you're, I, when you said, you know, again, back to this crowd and private, it's pretty intimate in that tent. There could have been 5 people in the tent or 50 people in the tent, but it felt private. It felt like, and that's why I think it's, there were many small groups of men that came in together very often. Mm. You know, classically bankers and farmers, you know, it wasn't class specific. It was a real mix of the local society. Mm. I think that it felt private to them. You know, somebody was performing for them and they become a group, a collective. And a one-to-one is a much more, think about it, you know, probably a scarier act for men, you know, to take on. So it's a much more comfortable space to be collectively watching some men, as I say, perform for others, daring to touch or daring to lick or daring to, you know, there was no penetration. So there was always a stage. Mm-hmm. But anything that could happen on this, when the women were squat, you can see that they're manhandled, as that phrase is appropriately right. used. You know?
Right. Yes, exactly.
And the women varied also as to whether or not they were willing to do so. Some were more distant and some were more interactive. But it's very important. It wasn't prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I was seeing when I came back to New York on 42nd Street, which was much more intense in some
right.
ways. And lap
right.
clubs began to become very prevalent in this period. I don't know the exact date, but I finished doing the work in 75. The book comes out in 76. You would by then begin to see lap clubs. I think there's another thing to note that the women who are performing in lap clubs in the cities have very different kinds of bodies and are much more professionalized in some ways than these girls who were running away from home and trying to get away from husbands or boyfriends or hitting the open road somewhat romantically, thinking there was another life somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them went home after many decades and some didn't. I lost track of many of them, though where I was in touch for when we did the second edition of the book 30 years later, I was able to find a number of women and bring them the second edition, which had a CD-ROM of their voices in it, which I always loved.
Wow.
Though that now has been replaced by a third edition, which I don't know if you saw at the Berlin show, but Carnival Strippers Revisited, you know, on really the 50th anniversary, I went back into the box that I'd packed up and found the contact sheets and more transcriptions and also color that I had photographed two cameras in the very early years. And, you know, if you remember in the early 70s, Kodachrome was an ASA 25 or 64. So it was limited what I could do in the daylight.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do as I progressed into the show. So I moved away from the color and stayed with the, you know, the black and white.
Right. Yeah.
But all of that came together in a book last year called Carnival Strippers Revisited, which is a two-book set and has the original book. And then the second book is The Making Of, which is really revisiting lots of decisions I made, and sharing contact sheets was an important part for me because there's so much other work that could have been part of this, could have been a movie had I had that technology that was at that time. And I'm trying to share with just what it felt like to be, people say, a fly on the wall. I don't like that expression because I don't think I was hiding myself. I was mm-hmm. present, mm-hmm. but not interested in them relating to me. I was wanting to be as invisible as I could be, but present at the same time.
Yeah.
And you feel that, I think, when you look at the contact sheets, you can sort of see that they're just going about the work that they're doing or hanging out together or whatever, and how I choose the frame that captures the best moment from my eyes. So it's intended to really, again, invite people into a process in a way the show does as well.
Yeah. And actually, like, so you're mentioning something that the fact that it's in many ways a multimedia project, and whether it's text, photos, audio recordings, you never did venture into, you certainly not on that project, didn't work in motion picture. Have you ever, have you stuck to just still photography, or have you?
Well, you saw in Nicaragua that I begin to do film, and the film is specifically 10 years later. I mean, I do a film with two partners, Richard Rogers and Alfred Gazzetti, who were friends and filmmakers themselves. And when I get to Nicaragua there, I begin to think about how time-based this revolutionary movement was that I covered mm-hmm. in 78, 79. I want to engage with people as time goes on, and that's a filmic form, takes filmic form, pictures from revolution, where I find the people in the photographs and then they comment about what's happened in their lives and what they feel about the revolution, etc.
Well, that's interesting too, because you just like, it seems to me that part of your personal interaction with your own work is, it seems to be like a revisiting of, you know, the fact that you're documenting something at a certain time, but then going back to it years later seems to be actually a sort of a, like a integral part of your process.
Yeah, I think making a funny way that just evolved, you know, this notion of the return of the image, the return of myself to the images I make, the life of the images that are outside of my life. My life is, of course, staccato with other projects that are smaller, that don't take book form or exhibition form. I think there are 10 projects in mediations, and they're still of different scale, mm-hmm. and they're different timelines. You know, the you would say the Irving Street project was only a couple of months, probably. Prince Street Girls is over maybe 5 years or 6 years, but then there's a leap into the moment when one of them gets married, which is somewhat later. Carnival Strippers is 3-4 summers and then a revisiting. And one of the elements I just added, the show is now in Antwerp, and I just added a carousel of other images, 50, I guess it's 80 other images that could have been in the book that weren't in the book, as a slideshow, because trying to repeat or give a feeling for how much you're sifting through as you make an object like a book is part of the process I wanted to share. Mm. Nicaragua is really, you could in some way say it's a 25-year spectrum, because I'm showcasing the work from the insurrection in 78, 79, and then how it gets used in the media. Then I go back for the 10th anniversary, and again with the murals from the photograph, with the photographs in on the 25th anniversary. So I'm trying to stretch time and reflection of memories of something like, as strong as that was, an insurrectional experience. And Kurdistan is also a long time frame. It's 6 years of research, but it's 100 years of photographs. So time is, I think, prevalent. But there are many things that I do that are much shorter and contained and don't invite that kind of longer reflection.
But so as far as your relationship then to the work, and this sort of, you know, return to it, or, you know, time passes and then you reapproach it. It makes me think about, and this is something just as a photographer or as a filmmaker, you know, you are crossing paths with people, and it may be for, you know, a stretch of time, whether it's girls in the neighborhood growing up, or the several seasons at the carnival, or the return to Nicaragua. You are a component in other people's lives for a passing moment, but they're part of your permanent story, and you have this evidence, right? And so you have a relationship with the people that you photographed. It seems to me that you were on their radar for a short amount of time, and then they continue on with their lives. They are with you forever. And so
that's exactly. And that's an astute observation. And that's well, there's sort of moments in Pictures from Revolution that are very startling, that I go to find someone and he remembers exactly when I took the photograph. But if you look at the photograph, you wouldn't know that he was conscious of my making the photograph. And he also tells me something that I would not know if he didn't tell me, which is that he only had 6 bullets in his rifle, which is an astoundingly, you know, piece of information when he's on an open street up facing, you know, a Somoza tank. You know, it was unbelievable to hear that. And there are other examples in the film where people remember having seen me. And that's, I think, part of what I wanted the viewer, or the, you know, the, in this case, seeing this movie, to be in multiple perspectives. My perspective is shared as to how I got to be in a certain moment in a particular place. And I ask that of them as well. So you're exactly right. It's that bizarre intersection for a moment, which could end up as a photograph or discarded, you know. Mm-hmm. But the ones that I revalue and then become part of a book, and then they see themselves in a book, is another stage of that process that I share with them. But of course, now it's been that much longer in time, and you can't constantly go back, you know. But of course, there's one wall in the show, as you would remember, called the Molotov Man, because mm-hmm. he's had many iterations out of my control and his control. He becomes symbolic up till the most recent period, where he's part of the resistance movement of the students against President Ortega, who's Sandinista, but nonetheless, the youth were in rebellion against him.
In that particular photograph, the Molotov Man, that became symbolic or an icon that was utilized numerous times, took on a life of its own. That man in the photograph was aware fairly early on that because that photograph, I'm sure, was in magazines all over the world. And
well, actually, it's not so much that it was in magazines all over the world, or that he would have seen them then. It's that the Matchbox covers for the first anniversary of the revolution were that image, were of that, used that image. And so the Matchbox cover did probably get into the hands of every Nicaraguan at the time, right? There was only one Matchbox company in Nicaragua at that moment. So think about that. You know, I don't think we were not yet in the age of the internet. So he would not have seen himself all over the internet then, but he has had a life on the internet since then. Mm. So I'm tracking that relationship as best I can. And I find, you know, every once in a while, somebody sends me a photograph by Banksy or a drawing by Banksy and says, "Are you sure he didn't rip you off?" And I thought, well, I don't own the gesture of a man throwing something. You know, maybe he saw that photograph, maybe he didn't, I don't know. But it's become a kind of universal gesture, which is interesting.
Yeah, and were you
partly through Banksy too? You know.
Yeah. That's. I think that might be sort of a moment for, let's say, a younger visitor to the exhibit that sees that photograph and maybe makes that connection with Banksy and the, you know, street art and that, just sort of that body movement or that. And I don't know if he was, I would assume that was his reference point when he created his version. But were you aware when you took that photograph that, I mean, that's just obviously a powerful moment in an environment that's just chaotic or life-threatening, right? And so when that moment happened, was it just part of this sort of like, deluge of chaos that was going on for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you point to that very well. I mean, actually, in the show, if you remember, I show the black and white contact sheet where I missed the photograph and a group of color pictures that were around that picture. And then I frame the picture of the moment right before and the moment. And that's because I think we are, when we're making photographs, pulling a second or less than a second, obviously, out of the flow of life. So I was with two cameras, a black and white and color, but I almost missed it completely. It becomes an icon out of accident in some ways that I capture it in one of those cameras. If it had been black and white, it might not have had the same, you know, ongoing life. Who knows? But that's part of what fascinates me about photography. You know, the framing of the frame, you know, how do you get to be in that place? Yes, I guess you could say it was life-threatening. I mean, I was a block from where the military were actively fighting against the Sandinistas. He was more exposed than I was. But nonetheless, he's got a Molotov cocktail and he's in front of a military tank, which they've just, I guess, been deactivated. But nonetheless, you can see it was an active front at that time.
What brought you to Nicaragua? It seems to me, looking at like your early work, to end up in a war zone, what It seems like obvious. How did that happen?
Well, when I've been asked that question, I sort of go back to earlier history, which is I was a 68er. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important because, you know, I was anti-war in my college years. I certainly marched on Washington and against the Pentagon and a lot of that. So when I read about what was happening in Nicaragua in the early 78 period, after they had Somoza had assassinated an opposition newspaper editor named Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, the whole country was in an uprising progressively over the next months. So I kept reading about this place. And of course, I didn't imagine it was going to be an armed insurrection. But I went really thinking about the civil strife. And that was comfortable enough to me. That was something I could relate to, you know, the fight against the dictatorship. I mean, Nixon wasn't a dictator, but we certainly were mobilized and we knew what it was like to collectively mobilize. And that's what I was reading about. So I think that was the connective moment, you know, abstractly. But I'd never worked in that way out of the country. The other important factor is that Carnival Strippers was the portfolio I brought to Magnum. And I was accepted, and I was in a very different kind of community. It was the first time I was really in a professional community of photographers who saw themselves in life, yes, doing street photography a la Cartier-Bresson, and yes, like Kappa on the front lines. And so there were many of my colleagues were traveling in that period to multiple places that were in stages of conflict, Ireland, you know, Iran, Portugal and Spain, you know, in over, you know, there was a lot happening in the period of the 70s when I entered Magnum. So that was the culture that surrounded me and maybe encouraged me. And on the end, at the same time, I wasn't on assignment. I went on my own and I stayed much longer than anyone would have paid me to be there probably too, you know.
Well, then, and thank you for that, that, because that context then does what you were surrounded by other people. This was sort of, you know, it doesn't feel like necessarily a stretch for you to end up where you were, you know, against the backdrop of being part of Magnum. And I didn't actually know the timing of when you actually first joined Magnum, and you're still with Magnum, correct? Are you the president of Magnum?
No, of the Magnum Foundation, which is a totally independent organization started by the Magnum photographers to support emerging photographers, mostly in the global South. Just knowing that, you know, as a field, you know, there's tremendous economic stress on long-term documentary work. And it's very difficult to survive doing it. And so when we created, and this is 15 years ago, we created the Magnum Foundation as a group of photographers thinking about the future, wanting to make sure there would be the capacity to continue to be out in the world as witnesses to the world, making sense of the world in whatever open way, independently of any publication.
Right. Yeah. Because
so that's basically what the mandate was and the mission was. And it's grown since then. We have a program in Beirut now, where we're supporting 10 photographers a year. There are almost 90 photographers in the Middle East, where none of them had had any previous training, or maybe one or two had, but for the most part, not. I go there in a couple of weeks to see this last group as a cohort. They work for 6 months on their own projects in their own countries, and they have two workshops with photographers both from the region and outside of the region. So it's just trying to keep a kind of coherent tradition of documentary expansive work.
And is it educational support and financial support? Is it
educational in the sense that it's mentoring?
Right.
And there are stipends to do the work. And there are various programs. We have another program called Counter Histories, which has been a grant to develop an independent project that really is a counter history to what is known. And they're very, very diverse projects that are globally, you know, quite distinctive. They just finished that. It's a 2-year commitment. The first year they developed the project, and the second year it could move into exhibition or book or public space format. So we're supporting ways in which documentary lives in our world and continues to be and is sustainable, hopefully.
And in against the backdrop of in many ways, the publication structure, a magazine, newspaper work that was probably the outlet when you were, now that doesn't necessarily exist. That
And that's important. Most people don't quite understand how you could, in that time, throughout the late 70s into the 80s and 90s, I was freelance. So that meant that I lived more off of what was published, not off of assignments to produce work for a magazine. So for the most part, they would pay for a cover or a small insert or a double spread. And that was all negotiated. And those second sales, what we would call second sales internationally, supported independent photographers to be where they wanted to be for long periods of time. I mean, Magnum is well known for its founding in 47, protecting the copyright of photographers, that they should own their work. Previous to that, most newspapers, many wires still today, and certainly magazines like Life and Look, owned the work that they paid. They considered it work for hire. So those photographers don't own their ongoing right to use that work. It's negotiated, but the fact is they didn't own it initially. And that's an important piece of this puzzle, that if you're going to survive as a photographer, you may have many ideas. We're talking about, I do go back to my archive. I create new work from it all the time. But if I didn't own it, I couldn't.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing for young photographers to think about. Obviously, the big question is, how do you sustain yourself over multiple decades? And that's a huge challenge. It's constantly a changing environment. People do many things. I mean, I have friends who drove taxis so that the work they made was, you know, totally independent of any compromises. And then there are other people who do advertising corporate, and that pays for their more personal projects, or people who have talent doing portraits. You know, everyone has to find some way to balance out what they're trying to make and who wants what they do, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to trade with something.
Right. So
maybe you're trading with podcasts, Nick.
Yeah. Well, I have a day job that gives me the flexibility of being in my studio. And as long as I'm answering my emails, I'm okay.
And everybody has to think about that in some way or other.
No, it's absolutely true. And that whole, the economics of sustaining, just like what you said, like who's funding the project? If it's self-funded and, you know, that gives you the freedom to tell the story exactly how you want, as opposed to if someone's bankrolling it, and then are you compromising the content or something because someone else is paying for it?
But as much as I would say that, you know, look, the environment has changed a lot. There are many more grants that were not there at all, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Certainly what we're doing with the Magnum Foundation is a part. National Geographic is very generous right now with grants. It could disappear again, but it's not sustainable as a life. You still have to bring many different elements together, I think, to survive as an active photographer.
Right, right. So I squeezed 50 minutes out of you.
I know. Here we are. Well, I hope that's a note of I want to be optimistic. I think when you're passionate about what you see and wanting to share with some reflection, some aspect of the world, I think there are ways to continue to make work. And that work can have lives, very different kinds of lives. I mean, many people believe Instagram is the life for the most purposeful. I don't know for myself if that's true, though I'm much more sporadic with Instagram, but I hope the next generation will figure out other ways to make important images live in our lives.
Right. Why don't we end it there? That's a nice little hopeful cherry on the...
A little hopeful. Let's stay hopeful.
Yes.
It's a tough world. Let's stay hopeful.
Love it. Yeah. Susan, okay. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thanks, Nick.
I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you. So there you go, folks. My conversation with the great photographer, Susan Mizellis. I will share links to all the work that we discussed in today's episode in the show notes. I would highly recommend getting the catalog that accompanies the exhibit Mediations. I picked up my copy on Amazon, but that's not an endorsement, but I know that you can pick up copies out there. And it's a wonderful combination of not only imagery, but a lot of really relevant text that brings a lot more insight to the work that Susan has created in her life. It was really an honor for me to talk to her. And just FYI, we did go back and forth quite a bit, and I was working through her assistant to line up the interview. And when Susan jumped on, I'm not 100% sure that she knew what was happening or who I was or why we were talking. And I was super intimidated, and I don't know if you can hear that in my voice, but I think the conversation really opened up, and I really, really enjoyed talking to her, and I hope you got a lot out of the conversation as well. So that's it, not only for this episode, but for this season. I'm going to take a couple of months off, but I will be back in September, and I'm going to bring some out of left field ideas to season three, maybe open things up subject-wise, but always focus on the hows and whys of the creative process, the visual arts, seeing the world through a camera or through other means. That's just a little teaser for you. I do have a couple of guests already lined up that I'm really excited to talk to and share with you. If you miss me and want to go back and listen to old episodes, they're all on my website, righteyedominantpodcast.com. Otherwise, see you in September. And until then, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The music for today's episode is brought to you by the Conant Project and Yazar. I made this, said Ubu said.